they said. I remarked that, as her mother had told me, she had not only for her friends but for the servants, for the poor, the most delicate attentions carefully thought out, a desire to give pleasure, a fear of causing annoyance, translated into all sorts of trifling actions, which must often have meant great inconvenience to her. She had done some work for our stallkeeper in the Champs-Élysées, and went out in the snow to give it to her with her own hands, so as not to lose a day. "You have no idea how kind-hearted she is. She won't let it be seen," her father assured me. Young as she was, she appeared far more sensible already than her parents. When Swann boasted of his wife's grand friends, Gilberte would turn away and remain silent, but without any air of reproaching him, for it seemed inconceivable to her that her father could be subjected to the slightest criticism. One day when I had spoken to her of Mademoiselle Vinteuil, she said to me, "I shall never know her, for a very good reason, and that is that she was not nice to her father, by what one hears. She gave him a lot of trouble. You can't understand that any more than I, can you? I'm sure you could no more live without your papa than I could, which is quite natural after all. How can one ever forget a person one has loved all one's life?" And once, when she was making herself particularly endearing to Swann, as I mentioned this to her when he was out of the room, "Yes, poor papa, it is the anniversary of his father's death just now. You can understand what he must be feeling. You do understand, don't you? You and I feel the same about things like that. So I just try to be a little less naughty than usual." "But he doesn't ever think you naughty. He thinks you're quite perfect." "Poor papa. That's because he's far too good himself." But her parents were not content with singing the praises of Gilberte, that same Gilberte who, even before I had set eyes on her, used to appear to me standing before a church in a landscape of the Île-de-France, and later, awakening in me not dreams now but memories, was embowered always in a hedge of pink hawthorn in the little lane that I took when I was going the Méséglise way. Once when I had asked Madame Swann, and had made an effort to assume the indifferent tone of a friend of the family, curious to know the preferences of a child, which among her playmates Gilberte liked the best, Madame Swann replied, "But you ought to know a great deal better than I do. You are in her confidence, her great favourite, her chum, as the English say." It appears that in a coincidence as perfect as this was, when reality is folded over to cover the ideal of which we have so long been dreaming, it completely hides that ideal, absorbing it in itself, as when two geometrical figures that are congruent are made to coincide, so that there is but one. Whereas we would rather, so as to give its full significance to our enjoyment, preserve for all those separate points of our desire, at the very moment in which we succeed in touching them, and so as to be quite certain that they are indeed themselves, the distinction of being intangible. And our thought cannot even reconstruct the old state so as to confront the new with it, for it has no longer a clear field. The acquaintance that we have made, the memory of those first unhoped-for moments, the talk to which we have listened, are there now to block the passage of our consciousness, and as they control the outlets of our memory far more than those of our imagination, they react more forcibly upon our past, which we are no longer able to visualize without taking them into account, than upon the form still unshaped of our future. I had been able to believe year after year that the right to visit Madame Swann was a vague and fantastic privilege to which I should never attain. After I had spent a quarter of an hour in her drawing-room, it was the period in which I did not yet know her that was become fantastic and vague, like a possibility which the realization of an alternative possibility has made impossible. How was I ever to dream again of her dining room as of an inconceivable place, when I could not make the least movement in my mind without crossing the path of that inextinguishable ray cast backwards to infinity, even into my own most distant past, by the lobster à l'américaine which I had just been eating? And Swan must have observed in his own case a similar phenomenon, for this house in which he entertained me might be regarded as the place into which had flowed, to coincide and be lost in one another, not only the ideal dwelling that my imagination had constructed, but another still, that which his jealous love, as inventive as any fantasy of mine, had so often depicted to him, that dwelling common to Odette and himself, which had appeared so inaccessible once, on evenings when Odette had taken him home with Forcheville to drink orangeade with her, and what had flowed in to be absorbed for him in the walls and furniture of the dining-room in which we now sat down to luncheon, was that unhoped-for paradise in which in the old days he could not without a pang imagine that he would one day be saying to their butler those very words, "Is Madame ready yet?" which I now heard him utter with a touch of impatience mingled with self-satisfaction. No more than probably Swan himself could I succeed in knowing my happiness, and when Gilberte once broke out, "Who would ever have said that the little girl you watch playing prisoner's bass without daring to speak to her would one day be your greatest friend, and you would go to her house whenever you liked?" She spoke of a change, the occurrence of which I could verify only by observing it from without, finding no trace of it within myself, for it was composed of two separate states, on both of which I could not, without their ceasing to be distinct from one another, succeed in keeping my thoughts fixed at one and the same time. And yet this house, because it had been so passionately desired by Swan, must have kept for him some of its attraction, if I was to judge by myself, for whom it had not lost all its mystery. That singular charm, in which I had for so long supposed the life of the Swans to be bathed, I had not completely exorcised from their house on making my own way into it. I had made it, that charm, recoil, overpowered as it must be by the sight of the stranger, the pariah that I had been, to whom now Madame Swan pushed forward graciously for him to sit in it, an armchair, exquisite, hostile, scandalized. But all round me, that charm in my memory I can still distinguish. Is it because on those days on which Monsieur and Madame Swan invited me to luncheon, to go out afterwards with them and Gilberte, I imprinted with my gaze, while I sat waiting for them there alone, on the carpet, the sofas, the tables, the screens, the pictures, the idea engraved upon my mind that Madame Swan or her husband or Gilberte was about to enter the room? Is it because those objects have dwelt ever since in my memory side by side with the Swans, and have gradually acquired something of their personal character? Is it because, knowing that the Swans passed their existence among all those things, I made of all of them, as it were, emblems of the private lives, of those habits of the Swans from which I had too long been excluded, for them not to continue to appear strange to me, even when I was allowed the privilege of sharing in them? However it may be, always when I think of that drawing-room which Swan, not that the criticism implied on his part any intention to find fault with his wife's taste, found so incongruous, because, while it was still planned and carried out in the style, half conservatory, half studio, which had been that of the rooms in which he had first known Odette, she had nonetheless begun to replace in its medley a quantity of the Chinese ornaments which she now felt to be rather gimcrack, a trifle dowdy, by a swarm of little chairs and stools and things upholstered in the old Louis XIV silks, not to mention the works of art brought by Swan himself from his house on the Quai d'Orléans. It is kept in my memory, on the contrary, that composite, heterogeneous room, a cohesion, a unity, an individual charm never possessed even by the most complete, the least spoiled of such collections that the past has bequeathed to us, or the most modern, alive and stamped with the imprint of a living personality. For we alone can, by our belief that they have an existence of their own, give to certain of the things that we see a soul, which they afterwards keep, which they develop in our minds. All the ideas that I had formed of the hours, different from those that exist for other men, passed by the swans in that house, which was to their life what the body is to the soul, and must give expression to its singularity, all those ideas were rearranged, amalgamated, equally disturbing and indefinite throughout, in the arrangement of the furniture, the thickness of the carpets, the position of the windows, the ministrations of the servants. When, after luncheon, we went in the sunshine to drink our coffee in the great bay window of the drawing-room, while Madame Swann was asking me how many lumps of sugar I took, it was not only the silk-covered stool which she pushed towards me that emitted with the agonizing charm that I had long ago felt, first among the pink hawthorn and then beside the clump of laurels, in the name of Gilberte, the hostility that her parents had shown to me, which this little piece of furniture seemed to have so well understood, to have so completely shared, that I felt myself unworthy and found myself almost reluctant to set my feet on its defenceless cushion. A personality, a soul was latent there, which linked it secretly to the light of 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so different from any other light, in the gulf in which there played about our feet its sparkling tide of gold, out of which the bluish crags of sofas and vaporous carpet beaches emerged like enchanted islands. And there was nothing, even to the painting by Rubens hung above the chimney-piece, that was not endowed with the same quality and almost the same intensity of charm as the laced boots of Monsieur Swann and that hooded cape, the like of which I had so dearly longed to wear, whereas now Odette would beg her husband to go and put on another so as to appear more smart whenever I did them the honour of driving out with them. She too went away to change her dress, not heeding my protestations that no outdoor clothes could be nearly so becoming as the marvellous garment of crepe de chine or silk, old rose, cherry-coloured, tiepolo pink, white, mauve, green, red or yellow, plain or patterned, in which Madame Swann had sat down to luncheon and which she was now going to take off. When I assured her that she ought to go out in that costume, she laughed, either in scorn of my ignorance or from delight in my compliment. She apologized for having so many wrappers, explaining that they were the only kind of dress in which she felt comfortable, and left us to go and array herself in one of those regal toilets which imposed their majesty on all beholders, and yet among which I was sometimes summoned to decide which of them I preferred that she should put on. In the Jardin d'Acclimatation, how proud I was when we had left the carriage to be walking by the side of Madame Swann. While she strolled carelessly on, letting her cloak stream on the air behind her, I kept eyeing her with an admiring gaze, to which she coquettishly responded in a lingering smile. And now, were we to meet one or other of Gilberte's friends, boy or girl, who saluted us from afar, I would in my turn be looked upon by them as one of those happy creatures whose lot I had envied, one of those friends of Gilberte who knew her family and had a share in that other part of her life, the part which was not spent in the Champs-Élysées. Often upon the paths of the Bois or the Jardin we passed, we were greeted by some great lady who was Swann's friend, whom he perchance did not see, so that his wife must rally him with a, "Charles, don't you see Madame de Montmorency?" And Swann, with that amicable smile, bred of a long and intimate friendship, bared his head, but with a slow, sweeping gesture, with a grace peculiarly his own. Sometimes the lady would stop, glad of an opportunity to show Madame Swan a courtesy which would involve no tiresome consequences, by which they all knew that she would never seek to profit, so thoroughly had Swan trained her in reserve. She had nonetheless acquired all the manners of polite society, and however smart, however stately the lady might be, Madame Swan was invariably a match for her. Halting for a moment before the friend whom her husband had recognized and was addressing, she would introduce us, Gilberte and myself, with so much ease of manner, would remain so free, so tranquil in her exercise of courtesy, that it would have been hard to say, looking at them both, which of the two was the aristocrat. The day on which we went to inspect the Cingalese, on our way home we saw coming in our direction, and followed by two others who seemed to be acting as her escort, an elderly but still attractive woman, cloaked in a dark mantle and capped with a little bonnet tied beneath her chin with a pair of ribbons. "Ah, here is someone who will interest you," said Swan. The old lady who had come within a few yards of us now smiled at us with a caressing sweetness. Swan doffed his hat. Madame Swan swept to the ground in a curtsy and made as if to kiss the hand of the lady, who, standing there like a Winterhalter portrait, drew her up again and kissed her cheek. "There, there! Will you put your hat on, you?" she scolded Swan in a thick and almost growling voice, speaking like an old and familiar friend.
"I am going to present you to Her Imperial Highness," Madame Swan whispered.
Swan drew me aside for a moment while his wife talked of the weather and of the animals recently added to the Jardin d'Acclimatation with the princess. "That is the Princess Mathilde," he told me. "You know who I mean, the friend of Flaubert, Sainte-Beuve, Dumas. Just fancy, she's the niece of Napoleon I. She had offers of marriage from Napoleon III and the Emperor of Russia. Isn't that interesting? Talk to her a little. But I hope she won't keep us standing here for an hour." "I met Taine the other day," he went on, addressing the princess, "and he told me that your highness was vexed with him." "He's behaved like a perfect pig," she said gruffly, pronouncing the word cochon as though she referred to Joan of Arc's contemporary, Bishop Cochon. "After his article on the Emperor, I left my card on him, with PPC on it." I felt the surprise that one feels on opening the correspondence of that Duchesse d'Orléans, who was by birth a Princess Palatine, and indeed, Princess Mathilde, animated by sentiments so entirely French, expressed them with a straightforward bluntness that recalled the Germany of an older generation, and was inherited doubtless from her Württemberg mother. This somewhat rude and almost masculine frankness she softened as soon as she began to smile with an Italian languor. And the whole person was clothed in a dress so typically Second Empire that for all that the princess wore it simply and solely, no doubt, from attachment to the fashions that she had loved when she was young, she seemed to have deliberately planned to avoid the slightest discrepancy in historic colour, and to be satisfying the expectations of those who looked to her to evoke the memory of another age. I whispered to Swan to ask her whether she had known Musset. "Very slightly, sir," was the answer, given in a tone which seemed to feign annoyance at the question, and of course it was by way of a joke that she called Swan Sir, since they were intimate friends. "I had him to dine once. I had invited him for 7 o'clock. At 7:30, as he had not appeared, we sat down to dinner. He arrived at 8, bowed to me, took his seat, never opened his lips, went off after dinner without letting me hear the sound of his voice. Of course, he was dead drunk." That hardly encouraged me to make another attempt. We were standing a little way off, Swan and I. "I hope this little audience is not going to last much longer," he muttered. "The soles of my feet are hurting.
I cannot think why my wife keeps on making conversation. When we get home, it'll be she that complains of being tired, and she knows I simply cannot go on standing like this.
For Madame Swann, who had had the news from Madame Bontemps, was in the course of telling the princess that the government, having at last begun to realize the depth of its depravity, had decided to send her an invitation to be present on the platform in a few days' time, when the Tsar Nicholas was to visit the Invalides. But the princess, who in spite of appearances, in spite of the character of her circle, which consisted mainly of artists and literary people, had remained at heart and showed herself, whenever she had to take action, the niece of Napoleon, replied, "Yes, madame, I received it this morning, and I sent it back to the minister, who must have had it by now. I told him that I had no need of an invitation to go to the Invalides. If the government desires my presence there, it will not be on the platform. It will be in our vault, where the emperor's tomb is. I have no need of a card to admit me there. I have my keys. I go in and out when I choose. The government has only to let me know whether it wishes me to be present or not. But if I do go to the Invalides, it will be down below there or nowhere at all." At that moment we were saluted, Madame Swann and I, by a young man who greeted her without stopping, and whom I was not aware that she knew. It was Bloch. I inquired about him, and was told that he had been introduced to her by Madame Bontemps, and that he was employed in the minister's secretariat, which was news to me. Anyhow, she could not have seen him often, or perhaps she had not cared to utter the name, hardly smart enough for her liking, of Bloch, for she told me that he was called Monsieur Moreuil. I assured her that she was mistaken, that his name was Bloch. The princess gathered up the train that flowed out behind her, while Madame Swann gazed at it with admiring eyes. "It is only a fur that the Emperor of Russia sent me," she explained, "and as I have just been to see him, I put it on, so as to show him that I'd managed to have it made up as a mantle."
"I hear that Prince Louis has joined the Russian army. The princess will be very sad at losing him," went on Madame Swann, not noticing her husband's signals of distress.
"That was a fine thing to do. As I said to him, just because there's been a soldier before in the family, that's no reason," replied the princess, alluding with this abrupt simplicity to Napoleon the Great. But Swann could hold out no longer. "Ma'am, it is I that am going to play the prince and ask your permission to retire. But you see, my wife has not been so well, and I do not like her to stand still for any time."
Madame Swann curtsied again, and the princess conferred upon us all a celestial smile, which she seemed to have summoned out of the past, from among the graces of her girlhood, from the evenings at Compiègne, a smile which glided sweet and unbroken over her hitherto so sullen face. Then she went on her way, followed by the two ladies-in-waiting who had confined themselves, in the manner of interpreters of children's or invalids' nurses, to punctuating our conversation with insignificant sentences and superfluous explanations.
"You should go and write your name in her book one day this week," Madame Swann counselled me. "One doesn't leave cards upon these royalties, as the English call them, but she will invite you to her house if you put your name down."
Sometimes in those last days of winter, we would go, before proceeding on our expedition, into one of the small picture shows that were being given at that time, where Swann, as a collector of mark, was greeted with special deference by the dealers in whose galleries they were held. And in that still wintry weather, the old longing to set out for the south of France and Venice would be reawakened in me by those rooms in which a springtime already well advanced and a blazing sun cast violet shadows upon the roseate Alpille and gave the intense transparency of emeralds to the Grand Canal. If the weather were inclement, we would go to a concert or a theatre, and afterwards to one of the fashionable tea-rooms. There, whenever Madame Swann had anything to say to me which she did not wish the people at the next table, or even the waiters who brought our tea, to understand, she would say it in English, as though that had been a secret language known to our two selves alone. As it happened, everyone in the place knew English. I only had not yet learned the language, and was obliged to say so to Madame Swann, in order that she might cease to make, on the people who were drinking tea or were serving us with it, remarks which I guessed to be uncomplimentary, without either my understanding or the person referred to losing a word. Once, in the matter of an afternoon at the theatre, Gilberte gave me a great surprise. It was precisely the day of which she had spoken to me some time back, on which fell the anniversary of her grandfather's death. We were to go, she and I, with her governess, to hear selections from an opera, and Gilberte had dressed with a view to attending this performance, and wore the air of indifference with which she was in the habit of treating whatever we might be going to do, with the comment that it might be anything in the world, no matter what, provided that it amused me and had her parents' approval. Before luncheon, her mother drew us aside to tell us that her father was vexed at the thought of our going to a theatre on that day. This seemed to me only natural. Gilberte remained impassive, but grew pale with an anger which she was unable to conceal. Still, she uttered not a word. When Monsieur Swann joined us, his wife took him to the other end of the room and said something in his ear. He called Gilberte, and they went together into the next room. We could hear their raised voices. And yet I could not bring myself to believe that Gilberte, so submissive, so loving, so thoughtful, would resist her father's appeal, on such a day and for so trifling a matter. At length Swann reappeared with her, saying, "You heard what I said. Now you may do as you like." Gilberte's features remained compressed in a frown throughout luncheon, after which we retired to her room. Then suddenly, without hesitating, and as though she had never at any point hesitated over her course of action, "2 o'clock," she exclaimed. "You know the concert begins at 1:30, and she told her governess to make haste. But, I reminded her, "won't your father be cross with you?" "Not the least little bit." "Surely he was afraid it would look odd, because of the anniversary." "What difference can it make to me what people think? I think it's perfectly absurd to worry about other people in matters of sentiment. We feel things for ourselves, not for the public. Mademoiselle has very few pleasures. She's been looking forward to going to this concert. I am not going to deprive her of it just to satisfy public opinion." "But Gilberte," I protested, taking her by the arm, "it is not to satisfy public opinion. It is to please your father." "You are not going to pass remarks upon my conduct, I hope," she said sharply, plucking her arm away. A favour still more precious than their taking me with them to the Jardin d'Acclimatation, the Swans did not exclude me even from their friendship with Bergotte, which had been at the root of the attraction that I had found in them when, before I had even seen Gilberte, I reflected that her intimacy with that godlike elder would have made her for me the most passionately enthralling of friends, had not the disdain that I was bound to inspire in her forbidden me to hope that she would ever take me in his company to visit the towns that he loved. And lo, one day came an invitation from Madame Swann to a big luncheon party. I did not know who else were to be the guests. On my arrival, I was disconcerted as I crossed the hall by an alarming incident. Madame Swann seldom missed an opportunity of adopting any of those customs which pass as fashionable for a season, and then, failing to find support, are speedily abandoned, as, for instance, many years before, she had had her private hansom, or now had printed in English upon a card inviting you to luncheon the words, "to meet," followed by the name of some more or less important personage. Often enough, these usages implied nothing mysterious and required no initiation. Take, for instance, a minute innovation of those days imported from England, Odette had made her husband have some visiting cards printed, on which the name Charles Swan was preceded by Mr. After the first visit that I paid her, Madame Swan had left at my door one of these pasteboards, as she called them. No one had ever left a card on me before. I felt at once so much pride, emotion, gratitude, that scraping together all the money I possessed, I ordered a superb basket of camellias and had it sent to Madame Swan. I implored my father to go and leave a card on her, but first, quickly, to have some printed on which his name should bear the prefix Mr. He vouchsafed neither of my prayers. I was in despair for some days, and then asked myself whether he might not, after all, have been right. But this use of Mr., if it meant nothing, was at least intelligible. Not so with another that was revealed to me on the occasion of this luncheon party, but revealed without any indication of its purport. At the moment when I was about to step from the hall into the drawing-room, the butler handed me a thin, oblong envelope, upon which my name was inscribed. In my surprise, I thanked him, but I eyed the envelope with misgivings. I no more knew what I was expected to do with it than a foreigner knows what to do with one of those little utensils that they lay by his place at a Chinese banquet. I noticed that it was gummed down. I was afraid of appearing indiscreet were I to open it then and there, and so I thrust it into my pocket with an air of knowing all about it. Madame Swan had written to me a few days before, asking me to come to luncheon with just a few people. There were, however, 16 of us, among whom I never suspected for a moment that I was to find Bergotte. Madame Swan, who had already named me, as she called it, to several of her guests, suddenly, after my name, in the same tone that she had used in uttering it, in fact, as though we were merely two of the guests at her party, who ought each to feel equally flattered on meeting each other, pronounced that of the sweet singer with the snowy locks. The name Bergotte made me jump like the sound of a revolver fired at me point blank, but instinctively, for appearance's sake, I bowed. There, straight in front of me, as by one of those conjurers whom we see standing whole and unharmed in their frock-coats, in the smoke of a pistol shot out of which a pigeon has just fluttered, my salute was returned by a young, common, little, thick-set, peering person, with a red nose curled like a snail shell and a black tuft on his chin. I was cruelly disappointed. For what had just vanished in the dust of the explosion was not only the feeble old man, of whom no vestige now remained, there was also the beauty of an immense work which I had contrived to enshrine in the frail and hallowed organism that I had constructed like a temple expressly for itself, but for which no room was to be found in the squat figure, packed tight with blood vessels, bones, muscles, sinews, of the little man with the snub nose and black beard who stood before me. All the Bergotte whom I had slowly and delicately elaborated for myself, drop by drop, like a stalactite, out of the transparent beauty of his books, ceased, I could see at once, to be of any use. The moment I was obliged to include him in the snail-shell nose and to utilize the little black beard, just as we must reject as worthless the solution of a problem the terms of which we have not read in full, having failed to observe that the total must amount to a specified figure. The nose and beard were elements similarly ineluctable, and all the more aggravating in that, while forcing me to reconstruct entirely the personage of Bergotte, they seemed further to imply, to produce, to secrete incessantly, a certain quality of mind, alert and self-satisfied, which was not in the picture, for such a mind had no connection whatever with the sort of intelligence that was diffused throughout those books, so intimately familiar to me, which were permeated by a gentle and godlike wisdom, Starting from them, I should never have arrived at that snail-shell nose. But starting from the nose, which did not appear to be in the slightest degree ashamed of itself, but stood out alone there like a grotesque ornament fastened on his face, I must proceed in a diametrically opposite direction from the work of Bergotte. I must arrive, it would seem, at the mentality of a busy and preoccupied engineer, of the sort who, when you accost him in the street, thinks it correct to say, "Thanks, and you?" before you have actually inquired of them how they are, or else, if you assure them that you have been charmed to make their acquaintance, respond with an abbreviation which they imagine to be effective, intelligent, and up-to-date, inasmuch as it avoids any waste of precious time on vain formalities. Same here. Names are, no doubt, but whimsical draughtsmen, giving us of people as well as of places sketches so little like the reality that we often experience a kind of stupor when we have before our eyes, in place of the imagined, the visible world, which for that matter is not the true world, our senses being little more endowed than our imagination with the art of portraiture, so little indeed that the final and approximately lifelike pictures which we manage to obtain of reality are at least as different from the visible world as that was from the imagined. But in Bergotte's case, my preconceived idea of him from his name troubled me far less than my familiarity with his work, to which I was obliged to attach, as to the cord of a balloon, the man with the little beard, without knowing whether it would still have the strength to raise him from the ground. It seemed quite clear, however, that it really was he who had written the books that I had so greatly enjoyed, for Madame Swann, having thought it incumbent upon her to tell him of my admiration for one of these, he showed no surprise that she should have mentioned this to him rather than to any other of the party, nor did he seem to regard her action as due to a misapprehension. But swelling out the frock coat which he had put on in honour of all these distinguished guests, with a body distended in anticipation of the coming meal, while his mind was completely occupied by other, more real and more important considerations, it was only as at some finished episode in his early life, as though one had made an allusion to a costume of the Duc de Guise which he had worn one season at a fancy dress ball, that he smiled as he bore his mind back to the idea of his books, which at once began to fall in my estimation, dragging down with them the whole value of beauty, of the world, of life itself, until they seemed to have been merely the casual amusement of a man with a little beard. I told myself that he must have taken great pains over them, but that if he had lived upon an island surrounded by beds of pearl oysters, he would instead have devoted himself to, and would have made a fortune out of, the pearling trade. His work no longer appeared to me so inevitable. And then I asked myself whether originality did indeed prove that great writers were gods, ruling each one over a kingdom that was his alone, or whether all that was not rather make-believe, whether the differences between one man's book and another's were not the result of their respective labours rather than the expression of a radical and essential difference between two contrasted personalities. Meanwhile, we had taken our places at the table. By the side of my plate I found a carnation, the stalk of which was wrapped in silver paper. It embarrassed me less than the envelope that had been handed to me in the hall, which, however, I had completely forgotten. This custom, strange as it was to me, became more intelligible when I saw all the male guests take up the similar carnations that were lying by their plates and slip them into the buttonholes of their coats. I did as they had done, with the air of spontaneity that a freethinker assumes in church, who is not familiar with the order of service, but rises when everyone else rises, and kneels a moment after everyone else is on his knees. Another usage, equally strange to me but less ephemeral, disquieted me more. On the other side of my plate was a smaller plate, on which was heaped a blackish substance which I did not then know to be caviar. I was ignorant of what was to be done with it, but firmly determined not to let it enter my mouth. Bergotte was sitting not far from me, and I could hear quite well everything that he said. I understood then the impression that Monsieur de Norpois had formed of him. He had indeed a peculiar organ. There is nothing that so much alters the material qualities of the voice as the presence of thought behind what one is saying, the resonance of one's diphthongs, the energy of one's labials are profoundly affected, in fact, one's whole way of speaking. His seemed to me to differ entirely from his way of writing, and even the things that he said from those with which he filled his books. But the voice issues from behind a mask, through which it is not powerful enough to make us recognize at first sight, a face which we have seen uncovered in the speaker's literary style. At certain points in the conversation, when Bergotte, by force of habit, began to talk in a way which no one but Monsieur de Norpois would have thought affected or unpleasant, it was a long time before I discovered an exact correspondence with the parts of his books in which his form became so poetic and so musical. At those points, I could see in what he was saying a plastic beauty independent of whatever his sentences might mean, and as human speech reflects the human soul, though without expressing it as does literary style, Bergotte appeared almost to be talking nonsense, intoning certain words, and, if he were secretly pursuing beneath them a single image, stringing them together uninterruptedly on one continuous note with a wearisome monotony. So that a pretentious, emphatic, and monotonous opening was a sign of the rare aesthetic value of what he was saying, and an effect in his conversation of the same power which in his books produced that harmonious flow of imagery. I had had all the more difficulty in discovering this at first, since what he said at such moments, precisely because it was the authentic utterance of Bergotte, had not the appearance of being Bergotte's. It was an abundant crop of clearly defined ideas, not included in that Bergotte manner which so many storytellers had appropriated to themselves, and this dissimilarity was probably but another aspect, made out with difficulty through the stream of conversation, as an eclipse is seen through a smoked glass, of the fact that when one read a page of Bergotte, it was never just what would have been written by any of those lifeless imitators who, nevertheless, in newspapers and in books, adorned their prose with so many Bergottish images and ideas. This difference in style arose from the fact that what was meant by Bergottism was, first and foremost, a priceless element of truth hidden in the heart of everything, whence it was extracted by that great writer by virtue of his genius, and that this extraction, and not simply the perpetration of Bergottisms, was my sweet singer's aim in writing. Though it must be added, he continued to perpetrate them in spite of himself, and because he was Bergotte, so that in one sense every fresh beauty in his work was the little drop of Bergotte buried at the heart of a thing which he had distilled from it. But if for that reason each of those beauties was related to all the rest and had a family likeness, yet each remained separate and individual, as was the act of discovery that had brought it to the light of day, new, and consequently different from what was called the Bergotte manner, which was a loose synthesis of all the Bergottisms already invented and set forth by him in writing, with no indication by which men who lacked genius might forecast what would be his next discovery. So it is with all great writers. The beauty of their language is as incalculable as that of a woman whom we have never seen. It is creative, because it is applied to an external object of which, and not of their language or its beauty, they are thinking, to which they have not yet given expression. An author of Memorials of Our Time, wishing to write without too obviously seeming to be writing like Saint-Simon, might on occasion give us the first line of his portrait of Villars. He was a rather tall man, dark, with an alert, open, expressive physiognomy. But what law of determinism could bring him to the discovery of Saint-Simon's next line, which begins with, "And, to tell the truth, a trifle mad"? The true variety is in this abundance of real and unexpected elements, in the branch loaded with blue flowers which thrust itself forward against all reason from the spring hedgerow that seemed already overcharged with blossoms, whereas the purely formal limitation of variety, and one might advance the same argument for all the other qualities of style, is but a barren uniformity, that is to say, the very antithesis of variety, and cannot in the work of imitators give the illusion or recall other examples of variety save to a reader who has not acquired the sense of it from the masters themselves. And so, just as Bergotte's way of speaking would no doubt have been charming if he himself had been merely an amateur repeating imitations of Bergotte, whereas it was attached to the mind of Bergotte, at work and in action, by essential ties which the ear did not at once distinguish, so it was because Bergotte applied that mind with precision to the reality which pleased him, that his language had in it something positive, something over-rich, disappointing those who expected to hear him speak only of the eternal torrent of forms, and of the mystic thrills of beauty. Moreover, the quality always rare and new of what he wrote was expressed in his conversation by so subtle a manner of approaching a question, ignoring every aspect of it that was already familiar, that he appeared to be seizing hold of an unimportant detail, to be quite wrong about it, to be speaking in paradox, so that his ideas seemed as often as not to be in confusion. For each of us finds lucidity only in those ideas which are in the same state of confusion as his own. Besides, as all novelty depends upon the elimination first of the stereotyped attitude to which we have grown accustomed, and which has seemed to us to be reality itself, every new conversation, as well as all original painting and music, must always appear laboured and tedious. It is founded upon figures of speech with which we are not familiar. The speaker appears to us to be talking entirely in metaphors, and this wearies us and gives us the impression of a want of truth. After all, the old forms of speech must in their time have been images difficult to follow when the listener was not yet cognizant of the universe which they depicted. But he has long since decided that this must be the real universe, and so relies confidently upon it. So when Bergotte, and his figures appear simple enough today, said of Cottard that he was a mannequin in a bottle, always trying to rise to the surface, and of Brichot that to him, even more than to Madame Swann, the arrangement of his hair was a matter for anxious deliberation, because in his twofold preoccupation over his profile and his reputation, he had always to make sure that it was so brushed as to give him the air at once of a lion and of a philosopher. One immediately felt the strain, and sought a foothold upon something which one called more concrete, meaning by that more ordinary. These unintelligible words, issuing from the mask that I had before my eyes, it was indeed to the writer whom I admired that they must be attributed. And yet they could not have been inserted among his books, in the form of a puzzle set in a series of different puzzles. They occupied another plane, and required a transposition by means of which one day, when I was repeating to myself certain phrases that I had heard Bergotte use, I discovered in them the whole machinery of his literary style, the different elements of which I was able to recognize and to name in this spoken discourse which had struck me as being so different. From a less immediate point of view, the special way, a little too meticulous, too intense, that he had of pronouncing certain words, certain adjectives which were constantly recurring in his conversation, and which he never uttered without a certain emphasis, giving to each of their syllables a separate force, and intoning the last syllable, as, for instance, the word visage, which he always used in preference to figure, and enriched with a number of superfluous V's and S's and G's, which seemed all to explode from his outstretched palm at such moments, corresponded exactly to the fine passages in which, in his prose, he brought those favourite words into the light, preceded by a sort of margin, and composed in such a way in the metrical whole of the phrase that the reader was obliged, if he were not to make a false quantity, to give to each of them its full value. And yet one did not find in the speech of Bergotte a certain luminosity which in his books, as in those of some other writers, often modified in the written phrase the appearance of its words. This was doubtless because that light issues from so profound a depth that its rays do not penetrate to our spoken words in the hours in which, thrown open to others by the act of conversation, we are to a certain extent closed against ourselves. In this respect, there were more intonations, there was more accent in his books than in his talk, an accent independent of the beauty of style, which the author himself has possibly not perceived, for it is not separable from his most intimate personality. It was this accent which, at the moments when in his books Bergotte was entirely natural, gave a rhythm to the words, often at such times quite insignificant, that he wrote. This accent is not marked on the printed page. There is nothing there to indicate it, and yet it comes of its own accord to his phrases. One cannot pronounce them in any other way. It is what was most ephemeral and at the same time most profound in the writer, and it is what will bear witness to his true nature. What will say whether, despite all the austerity he has expressed, he was gentle, despite all his sensuality, sentimental. Certain peculiarities of elocution, faint traces of which were to be found in Bergotte's conversation, were not exclusively his own, for when, later on, I came to know his brothers and sisters, I found those peculiarities much more accentuated in their speech. There was something abrupt and harsh in the closing words of a light and spirited utterance, something faint and dying at the end of a sad one. Swann, who had known the master as a boy, told me that in those days one used to hear on his lips, just as much as on his brothers and sisters, those inflections, almost a family type, shouts of violent merriment interspersed with murmurings of a long-drawn melancholy, and that in the room in which they all played together, he used to perform his part better than any of them in their symphonies, alternately deafening and subdued. However characteristic it may be, the sound that escapes from human lips is fugitive, and does not survive the speaker. But it was not so with the pronunciation of the Bergotte family. For if it is difficult ever to understand, even in the Meistersinger, how an artist can invent music by listening to the twittering of birds, yet Bergotte had transposed and fixed in his written language that manner of dwelling on words which repeat themselves in shouts of joy, or fall drop by drop in melancholy sighs. There are in his books just such closing phrases where the accumulated sounds are prolonged, as in the last chords of the overture of an opera which cannot come to an end, and repeats several times over its supreme cadence before the conductor finally lays down his baton. in which, later on, I was to find a musical equivalent for those phonetic brasses of the Bergotte family. But in his own case, from the moment in which he transferred them to his books, he ceased instinctively to make use of them in his speech. From the day on which he had begun to write, all the more markedly, therefore, in the later years in which I first knew him, his voice had lost this orchestration for ever. These young Bergottes, the future writer and his brothers and sisters, were doubtless in no way superior, far from it, to other young people more refined, more intellectual than themselves, who found the Bergottes rather loud, that is to say, a trifle vulgar, irritating one by the witticisms which characterized the tone, at once pretentious and puerile, of their household. But genius, and even what is only great talent, springs less from seeds of intellect and social refinement superior to those of other people than from the faculty of transposing and so transforming them. To heat a liquid over an electric lamp, one requires to have not the strongest lamp possible, but one of which the current can cease to illuminate, can be diverted so as instead of light to give heat. To mount the skies, it is not necessary to have the most powerful of motors. One must have a motor which, instead of continuing to run along the earth's surface, intersecting with a vertical line the horizontal which it began by following, is capable of converting its speed into ascending force. Similarly, the men who produce works of genius are not those who live in the most delicate atmosphere, whose conversation is most brilliant or their culture broadest, but those who have had the power, ceasing in a moment to live only for themselves, to make use of their personality as of a mirror, in such a way that their life, however unimportant it may be socially, and even in a sense intellectually speaking, is reflected by it. Genius consisting in the reflective power of the writer, and not in the intrinsic quality of the scene reflected. The day on which young Bergotte succeeded in showing to the world of his readers the tasteless household in which he had passed his childhood, and the not very amusing conversations between himself and his brothers, on that day he climbed far above the friends of his family, more intellectual and more distinguished than himself. They, in their fine Rolls-Royces, might return home expressing due contempt for the vulgarity of the Bergottes. But he, with his modest engine which had at last left the ground, he soared above their heads. But there were other characteristics of his elocution, which it was not with the members of his family, but with certain contemporary writers that he must share. Younger men, who were beginning to repudiate him as a master, and disclaimed any intellectual affinity to him in themselves, displayed their affinity without knowing it, when they made use of the same adverbs, the same prepositions that he incessantly repeated, when they constructed their sentences in the same way, spoke in the same quiescent, lingering tone, by a reaction from the eloquent, easy language of an earlier generation. Perhaps these young men, we shall come across some of whom this may be said, had never known Bergotte. But his way of thinking, inoculated into them, had led them to those alterations of syntax and of accent which bear a necessary relation to originality of mind, a relation which, incidentally, requires to be traced. Thus Bergotte, if he owed nothing to any man for his manner of writing, derived his manner of speaking from one of his early associates, a marvellous talker to whose ascendancy he had succumbed, whom he imitated unconsciously in his conversation, but who himself, being less gifted, had never written any really outstanding book. So that if one had been in quest of originality in speech, Bergotte must have been labelled a disciple, a writer at second hand. Whereas, influenced by his friend only so far as talk went, he had been original and creative in his writings. doubtless again, so as to distinguish himself from the previous generation, too fond as it had been of abstractions, of weighty commonplaces, when Bergotte wished to speak favourably of a book, what he would bring into prominence, what he would quote with approval, would always be some scene that furnished the reader with an image, some picture that had no rational significance. "Ah, yes," he would exclaim, "it is quite admirable. There is a little girl in an orange shawl. It is excellent." Or again, "Oh, yes, there is a passage in which there is a regiment marching along the street. Yes, it is excellent." As for style, he was not altogether of his time, though he remained quite exclusively of his race, abominating Tolstoy, George Eliot, Ibsen, and Dostoevsky, for the word that always came to his lips when he wished to praise the style of any writer was mild. "Yes, you know, I like Chateaubriand better in Atala than in René. He seems to me to be milder." He said the word like a doctor who, when his patient assures him that milk will give him indigestion, answers, "But you know, it's very mild." And it is true that there was in Bergotte's style a kind of harmony, similar to that for which the ancients used to praise certain of their orators, in terms which we now find it hard to understand, accustomed as we are to our own modern tongues, in which effects of that kind are not sought. He would say also, with a shy smile, of pages of his own for which someone had expressed admiration, "I think it is more or less true, more or less accurate. It may be of some value, perhaps." But he would say this simply from modesty. As a woman to whom one has said that her dress or her daughter is charming replies, "It is comfortable," or "She is a good girl." But the constructive instinct was too deeply implanted in Bergotte for him not to be aware that the sole proof that he had built usefully and on the lines of truth lay in the pleasure that his work had given to himself, first of all, and afterwards to his readers. Only many years later, when he no longer had any talent, whenever he wrote anything with which he was not satisfied, so as not to have to suppress it, as he ought to have done, so as to be able to publish it with a clear conscience, he would repeat, but to himself this time, "After all, it is more or less accurate. It must be of some value to the country." So that the phrase murmured long ago among his admirers by the insincere voice of modesty came in the end to be whispered in the secrecy of his heart by the uneasy tongue of pride. And the same words which had served Bergotte as an unwanted excuse for the excellence of his earliest works became, as it were, an ineffective consolation to him for the hopeless mediocrity of the latest. A kind of austerity of taste which he had, a kind of determination to write nothing of which he could not say that it was mild, which had made people for so many years regard him as a sterile and precious artist, a chiseller of exquisite trifles, was on the contrary the secret of his strength. For habit forms the style of the writer just as much as the character of the man. And the author who has more than once been patient to attain in the expression of his thoughts to a certain kind of attractiveness, in so doing lays down unalterably the boundaries of his talent, just as if he yields too often to pleasure, to laziness, to the fear of being put to trouble, he will find himself describing in terms which no amount of revision can modify the forms of his own vices and the limits of his virtue. If, however, despite all the analogies which I was to perceive later on between the writer and the man, I had not at first sight in Madame Swann's drawing-room believed that this could be Bergotte, the author of so many divine books, who stood before me, perhaps I was not altogether wrong, for he himself did not, in the strict sense of the word, believe it either. He did not believe it because he showed a great assiduity in the presence of fashionable people, and yet he was not a snob, of literary men and journalists who were vastly inferior to himself. Of course, he had long since learnt from the suffrage of his readers that he had genius, compared to which social position and official rank were as nothing. He had learned that he had genius, but he did not believe it, because he continued to simulate deference towards mediocre writers in order to succeed shortly in becoming an academician, whereas the Academy and the Faubourg Saint-Germain have no more to do with that part of the eternal mind which is the author of the works of Bergotte than with the laws of causality or the idea of God. That also he knew. But as a kleptomaniac knows without profiting by the knowledge that it is wrong to steal. And the man with the little beard and snail shell nose knew and used all the tricks of the gentleman who pockets your spoons in his efforts to reach the coveted academic chair or some duchess or other who could dispose of several votes at the election. But while on his way to them, he would endeavour to make sure that no one who would consider the pursuit of such an object a vice in him should see what he was doing. He was only half successful. One could hear, alternating with the speech of the true Bergotte, that of the other Bergotte, ambitious, utterly selfish, who thought it not worth his while to speak of any but his powerful, rich, or noble friends, so as to enhance his own position. He who in his books, when he was really himself, had so well portrayed the charm, pure as a mountain spring, of poverty. As for those other vices to which Monsieur de Norpois had alluded, that almost incestuous love, which was made still worse, people said, by a want of delicacy in the matter of money, if they contradicted in a shocking manner the tendency of his latest novels, in which he showed everywhere a regard for what was right and proper, so painfully rigid that the most innocent pleasures of their heroes were poisoned by it, and that even the reader found himself turning their pages with a sense of acute discomfort, and asked himself whether it was possible to go on living even the quietest of lives, those vices did not at all prove, supposing that they were fairly imputed to Bergotte, that his literature was a lie, and all his sensitiveness mere play-acting. Just as in pathology certain conditions similar in appearance are due some to an excess, others to an insufficiency of tension, of secretion, and so forth, so there may be vice arising from supersensitiveness, just as much as from the lack of it. Perhaps it is only in really vicious lives that the moral problem can arise in all its disquieting strength. And of this problem the artist finds a solution in the terms not of his own personal life, but of what is for him the true life in general, a literary solution. As the great doctors of the church began often without losing their virtue by acquainting themselves with the sins of all mankind, out of which they extracted their own personal sanctity, so great artists often, while being thoroughly wicked, make use of their vices in order to arrive at a conception of the moral law that is binding upon us all. It is the vices, or merely the weaknesses and follies, of the circle in which they live, the meaningless conversation, the frivolous or shocking lives of their daughters, the infidelity of their wives, or their own misdeeds, that writers have most often castigated in their books, without, however, thinking it necessary to alter their domestic economy or to improve the tone of their households. And this contrast had never before been so striking as it was in Bergotte's time. Because, on the one hand, in proportion as society grew more corrupt, our notions of morality were increasingly exalted, while on the other hand, the public were now told far more than they had ever hitherto known about the private lives of literary men. And on certain evenings in the theatre, people would point out the author whom I had so greatly admired at Cambrai, sitting at the back of a box, the mere composition of which seemed an oddly humorous, or perhaps keenly ironical commentary upon, a brazen-faced denial of, the thesis which he had just been maintaining in his latest book. Not that anything which this or that casual informant could tell me was of much use in helping me to settle the question of the goodness or wickedness of Bergotte. An intimate friend would furnish proofs of his hard-heartedness. Then a stranger would cite some instance, touching, since he had evidently wished it to remain hidden, of his real depth of feeling. He had behaved cruelly to his wife, but in a village inn, where he had gone to spend the night, he had stayed on to watch over a poor woman who had tried to drown herself, and when he was obliged to continue his journey, had left a large sum of money with the landlord so that he should not turn the poor creature out, but see that she got proper attention. Perhaps the more the great writer was developed in Bergotte at the expense of the little man with the beard, so much the more his own personal life was drowned in the flood of all the lives that he imagined, until he no longer felt himself obliged to perform certain practical duties for which he had substituted the duty of imagining those other lives. But at the same time, because he imagined the feelings of others as completely as if they had been his own, whenever he was obliged for any reason to talk to some person who had been unfortunate, that is to say, in a casual encounter, he would, in doing so, take up not his own personal standpoint, but that of the sufferer himself, a standpoint in which he would have been horrified by the speech of those who continued to think of their own petty concerns in the presence of another's grief, with the result that he gave rise everywhere to justifiable rancor and to undying gratitude. Above all, he was a man who in his heart of hearts loved nothing really except certain images, and, like a miniature set in the floor of a casket, the composing and painting of them in words. For a trifle that someone had sent him, if that trifle gave him the opportunity of introducing one or two of these images, he would be prodigal in the expression of his gratitude, while showing none whatever for an expensive present. And if he had had to plead before a tribunal, he would inevitably have chosen his words not for the effect that they might have on the judge, but with an eye to certain images which the judge would certainly never have perceived. That first day on which I met him with Gilberte's parents, I mentioned to Bergotte that I had recently been to hear Berma in Phèdre, and he told me that in the scene in which she stood with her arm raised to the level of her shoulder, one of those very scenes that had been greeted with such applause, she had managed to suggest with great nobility of art certain classical figures which, quite possibly, she had never even seen, a Hesperid carved in the same attitude upon a metope at Olympia, and also the beautiful primitive virgins on the Erechtheum. It may be sheer divination, and yet I fancy that she visits the museums. It would be interesting to establish that. Establish was one of those regular Bergotte expressions, and one which various young men who had never met him had caught from him, speaking like him by some sort of telepathic suggestion.
"Do you mean the caryatids?" asked Swann.
"No, no," said Bergotte. "Except in the scene where she confesses her passion to Oenone, where she moves her hand exactly like Hegeso on the steel in the ceramic, it is a far more primitive art that she revives. I was referring to the chorae of the old Erechtheum, and I admit that there is perhaps nothing quite so remote from the art of Racine, but there are so many things already in Phèdre that one more—" "Oh, and then, yes, she is really charming, that little sixth-century Phèdre, the rigidity of the arm, the lock of hair frozen into marble. Yes, you know, it is wonderful of her to have discovered all that. There is a great deal more antiquity in it than in most of the books they are labelling antique this year." As Bergotte had in one of his volumes addressed a famous invocation to these archaic statues, the words that he was now uttering were quite intelligible to me, and gave me a fresh reason for taking an interest in Berma's acting. I tried to picture her again in my mind, as she had looked in that scene in which I remembered that she had raised her arm to the level of her shoulder, and I said to myself, "There we have the Hesperid of Olympia. There we have the sister of those adorable suppliants on the Acropolis. There is indeed nobility in art." But if these considerations were to enhance for me the beauty of Berma's gesture, Bergotte should have put them into my head before the performance. Then, while that attitude of the actress was actually existing in flesh and blood before my eyes, at that moment in which the thing that was happening had still the substance of reality, I might have tried to extract from it the idea of archaic sculpture. But of Berma in that scene, all that I retained was a memory which was no longer liable to modification, slender as a picture which lacks that abundant perspective of the present tense, where one is free to delve and can always discover something new, a picture to which one cannot retrospectively give a meaning that is not subject to verification and correction from without. At this point, Madame Swann joined in the conversation, asking me whether Gilberte had remembered to give me what Bergotte had written about Phèdre, and adding, "My daughter is such a scatterbrain." Bergotte smiled modestly and protested that they were only a few pages of no importance. "But it is perfectly charming, that little pamphlet, that little tract of yours," Madame Swann assured him, to show that she was a good hostess, to make the rest of us think that she had read Bergotte's essay, and also because she liked not merely to flatter Bergotte, but to make a selection for herself out of what he wrote, to control his writing. And it must be admitted that she did inspire him, though not in the way that she supposed. But when all is said, there is, between what constituted the smartness of Madame Swann's drawing-room and a whole side of Bergotte's work, so close a correspondence that either of them might serve among elderly men today as a commentary upon the other. I let myself go in telling him what my impressions had been. Often Bergotte disagreed, but he allowed me to go on talking. I told him that I had liked the green light which was turned on when Phèdre raised her arm. "Ah, the designer will be glad to hear that. He is a real artist. I shall tell him you liked it, because he is very proud of that effect. I must say myself that I do not care for it very much. It drowns everything in a sort of aqueous vapour. Little Phèdre standing there looks too like a branch of coral on the floor of an aquarium. You will tell me, of course, that it brings out the cosmic aspect of the play. That is quite true. All the same, it would be more appropriate if the scene were laid in the court of Neptune. Oh, yes, of course, I know the vengeance of Neptune does come into the play. I don't suggest for a moment that we should think only of Port-Royal. But after all, the story that Racine tells us is not the loves of the sea urchins. Still, it is what my friend wished to have, and it is very well done, right or wrong, and it's really quite pretty when you come to look at it." "Yes, so you liked that, did you? You understood what it meant, of course. We feel the same about it, don't we, really? It is a trifle unbalanced what he's done. You agree with me, but on the whole it is very clever of him." And so, when Bergotte had to express an opinion which was the opposite of my own, he in no way reduced me to silence, to the impossibility of framing any reply, as Monsieur de Norpois would have done. This does not prove that Bergotte's opinions were of less value than the ambassador's. Far from it. A powerful idea communicates some of its strength to him who challenges it. Being itself a part of the riches of the universal mind, it makes its way into, grafts itself upon the mind of him whom it is employed to refute, slips in among the ideas already there, with the help of which, gaining a little ground, he completes and corrects it. So that the final utterance is always to some extent the work of both parties to a discussion. It is to ideas which are not, properly speaking, ideas at all, to ideas which, founded upon nothing, can find no support, no kindred spirit among the ideas of the adversary, that he, grappling with something which is not there, can find no word to say in answer. The arguments of Monsieur de Norpois in the matter of art were unanswerable simply because they were without reality. Since Bergotte did not sweep aside my objections, I confessed to him that they had won the scorn of Monsieur de Norpois. "But he's an old parrot," was the answer. "He keeps on pecking you because he imagines all